I'd like to think that we can agree that good feelings are good and bad feelings are bad. We can make it as complex as we want because you can discuss endlessly about what is the best feeling and what is the worst feeling. Like, is a panic attack the worst feeling? Is a psychosis a bad feeling? Is being depressed a bad feeling? But I know that I prefer to be ecstatic over being depressed. And I think there are some general rules we can agree on. And whether that's true or not, I don't fucking care, because it's, for me, it's true. Like, for it's if we are starting to doubt that, then we can, then no single conversation has any purpose, right? That's a bit how I see it. Like, how do you see that?
I'm not sure if that's true, if there's nothing you can build out of from. Because if you're questioning the thesis that not even suffering is real,
mm-hmm.
you are at least saying that the thesis that questioning that suffering is real is real. At least that thing that you are questioning is real. Why do you like donuts?
Why I like donuts? Because they make me feel very good.
I've talked about this with my friend Patrick recently in a podcast that will be uploaded before this one. And I think that the reason why you like donuts, but you don't want to like donuts, is that there's a mismatch between your first layer and second layer desires. And this also happens with the movement of effective altruism.
Yes, yes.
People like considering themselves to be people who would want to maximize well-being in the world.
Yeah.
But they end up falling for the thing that makes you feel as if you are maximizing the impact.
So exactly. So what you're saying is that I like donuts. I want donuts, right? Like, if you offer me a donut, it's going to be very, very difficult to say no to that, because I really love donuts. But I don't want to want donuts, right? The idea of effective altruism is that you do the most effective good you can do. Like, I can donate money to this organization that knows it, knows how to do good in the most efficient way ever. Or I could buy food and share it to homeless people in my own street or in my own city. Okay, that's less effective. So I decide to donate it to an organization, or decide to do whatever would be the most efficient option. But then what you notice is that the thing that's the most efficient doesn't make you feel the best, right?
Yeah.
Because the most efficient is often a very kind of boring, kind of rational choice, not per se a boring choice, but a rational choice. And we feel very good if we give something directly to people, we feel like we're doing good. And if you donate your money to an organization, you feel, you don't really feel like you're doing good. It's very anonymous, right? So that's a bit the idea, right? The comparison between the donut and and effective altruism. That's a bit what you want to say by that, right?
Yeah. Yes, there's a mismatch between what you feel and what you, and the impact you have. Those should be aligned, but they are not. And we are able to notice that misalignment. See, we're able to see how you should be feeling orders of magnitude better than you actually do by giving a check to a nonprofit. But why do we not feel orders of magnitude better than we actually should, according to judging the fact that you feel good when you give some chocolate to a homeless person? Maybe not chocolate, that's maybe unhealthy, but lettuce. You give it to him.
Yeah.
And he's happy, and you're happy.
Uh-huh.
But if the impact you're causing by donating 100 euros to a nonprofit of Somalia is 1,000 times bigger than that of you giving a lettuce to that homeless person in front of your house, you're not going to feel 1,000 times better. And I think that
maybe you even feel worse.
Yeah.
Be the case. Or less good. Let's say like that.
Yes. Yeah. This reminds me of, there was an experiment by, I don't know what researcher now, I'm sorry for not being able to point you in the direction of this research, but it was basically, they were trying to see how much people were willing to donate to a nonprofit, and they had different campaigns working. One of them was, they had a picture of a cute little girl who was...
I think I know this research, so I also don't know the name, but I've heard about this. Yeah.
Okay.
Tell me.
And it was basically, they were asking people, how much would you be willing to donate to this nonprofit corporation so that you help this girl or this cause in progressing towards getting better? And people were, the maximum amount of the of will that they showed was when there was a single little girl who seemed to be suffering.
Mm-hmm.
But when you added his siblings to the picture, people were willing to donate not more, but less. So there's there's a complete, this is the perfect representation of how our desires are not aligned with what we would feel like should be.
It's interesting because I also, it makes me think of the famous quote. I think like one person is a human and 100 people is statistics.
Yeah, that was Stalin, I think.
Could be.
He said, one death is a tragedy.
Yeah, yes, it was like that.
And a million is a statistic.
Yeah, but it's like that. If you hear that, so that a big group of people is in trouble, you're less willing to help. You're less willing to help. I think also because it's like, it feels like a drop in the ocean because you know that your money is not going to help the whole group. So conceptually, it's like less attractive. You don't take away the problem. You reduce the problem a bit, but it's at the same time painful to see that you only can do a little bit, right? So it's like, yeah, I think it has to do a bit with that, but yeah, it's definitely interesting. But then the question is for me how we could kind of compensate for our lack in a good emotional judgment of what we should do, right? Because you know that you know that one thing is good to do and the other is not so good to do, or one is 1,000 times better than the other. But then, but only with that realization doesn't yet motivate you to come into action. Because me, for example, I'm kind of enthusiastic about effective altruism. And I love the idea and I love the philosophy. But I'm not even an effective altruist myself. I just love the concept. But then to bring it into practice, you need more than a rational understanding. You need more than just enthusiasm for the concept, because it's like not so. I think it's not so in line with how we work psychologically, and I think that, well, what's interesting to think about, how we can push ourselves to act in an effective altruistic way. But I don't know, it's an open question. I don't have the answer, but how can we make ourselves more effective altruists?
Think of it from an evolutionary perspective. When in our evolutionary heritage would it have made any sense at all for us to feel the highest level of hijack or emotion when a big group of people is being in a suboptimal situation or they are suffering due to, let's say, what the non-maximum reaction happened in the example of the small little girl who was suffering when she was next to her family. That is the case because feelings are aligned to what maximized our, not even our, feelings are aligned to what maximizes the spread of the genes we have. They are not aligned with anything else. And the way of maximizing the spreading of the genes in our evolutionary heritage was not through rationalizing things in the way we are doing now. Those things, one, were not affordable before. You couldn't invest as much time as we do now in reading or thinking of abstract concepts as people before were not able to do that. And even if you did, you would not maximize the chances of your genes spreading by doing that. And because the way of spreading the genes, which is the only relevant factor here, because if those genes were not capable of spreading, we wouldn't see them now. So we are the descendants of a non-broken chain of millions of people reproducing. not a single one of our ancestors has not reproduced.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing. That's just astonishing.
It's incredible.
Statistically, yeah. If you try to get 1,000 people from 1,000 years ago, who all of them were going to reproduce,
mm-hmm.
from a random sample of the population,
mm-hmm.
the odds of you getting that would be less than 1 in 1,000 million.
Yeah.
There's not a combination.
Great. It's quite cool. Uh-huh.
So that makes me think that our feelings, it's not like I'm getting out of the biological restraints by having these thoughts. I'm still being restrained by physical limitations. There's not a single physical law that I'm violating by having these thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that I have been equipped with this capacity to develop this argument
mm-hmm.
in a way that detects that our evolutionary environment is not aligned with ours now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very radical question. If it would be possible to change our genes in a way that we would be more altruistic, would that be an ethical thing to do? Or maybe should we feel obliged to do that? Should we do that?
Well, it depends on how serious of a response you want from me. If I'm trying to respond this mm-hmm. in the most serious way I can,
mm-hmm.
the only thing I can say is that I do not know the impact of such measures.
No.
And I do not know if those things would be desirable. Because mm-hmm. there's some things that are in the spectrum of genetic modification, there's some things that are less controversial or more evidently positive, like
yeah.
eliminating genetical diseases that yeah. are inherited.
Yeah.
Those things, okay, no one would say, or not many people would say that those things are bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's modify the genes of my children so that they don't get the same disease I got
mm-hmm.
and I suffered through.
Mm-hmm.
That's most of the people would agree with that. But what about increasing their IQ so that they have the IQ of Einstein?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they were already going to be on the average. What need is there to increase them farther from the average? Not as many people would agree with me in that that's moral.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but everyone benefits from altruistic people. Like someone with a high IQ, the benefit of having high IQ or a low IQ is your IQ is very relative, right? So whether you're smarter or stupid and is very dependent on your environment. So if everyone would increase its IQ through genes, then the standard would become higher and it would be a kind of race of the one with the most money can maybe change his IQ the most. I don't know. It's a bit like it's a bit abstract and it wouldn't be like that. But imagine like that. So the people that have access to changing their DNA will gain more power because they are the ones who get a higher IQ. But with altruism, imagine if we could make ourselves more altruistic or we could increase our empathy. In theory, it could be something that everyone benefits of because I wouldn't like you to have an IRQ because that means that my IQ is relatively lower. And I'd love you to be more empathic because it's a benefit for me.
Mm.
So in that sense, I mean, this is not something that is going to happen in the short term, but it's interesting to think about it. Like on an abstract level or theoretical level, if in 200 years time this would be possible, like.
But depends on what you are aspiring to.
Mm.
Because if you are seeking for status, you're required to be above average. There's no other way. But if you're not seeking for status and you're seeking for absolute well-being,
mm-hmm.
you're trying to maximize the well-being of the most people the most you can. And you don't care if it is if the best way to increase the well-being in the world would be to increase the income of everyone else in the world by mm-hmm. 1,000-fold and yours only 10-fold, if you were trying to maximize the absolute well-being of the world, you would do it. But that's not the case, and there has been many studies showing that people would rather decrease their income if that means decreasing the people of their environment more than increasing it if it means increasing the other people more.
Mm.
They really care, and I'm not excluding myself from this, about status and feeling like you are above average in the hierarchy you're fighting for. And that that characteristic that we're talking about could also be modified. And now my reasoning tells me that that seeking for status and perceiving society as a zero-sum game in some ways is negative, and we could eliminate that feature so that we could not feel that zero-sum game feeling anymore, and we would be focusing in the absolute well-being of society. And once we do that, you wouldn't care about other people becoming as intelligent as they could if that's cost-effective.
Yeah.
In absolute terms. But it's also true that it's, how do you call this? It's a loop that feeds itself. If people get more IQ, the technology to increase IQ will be reduced in cost because people will be more intelligent to be able to develop better technology, which will enable them.
Yes.
I think that's something similar to what in artificial intelligence is called the singularity.
Yeah.
Once we get a computer to be able to simulate the intelligence of humans in a general way, and the thing that has built that computer is a human mind, that computer will be able to program something that's better programmed than himself, so that the next version, the version 2.0 of that super artificial intelligence, will be able to program itself better than the previous one. And so an exponential increase in intelligence will be generated that's called the singularity. Yeah. Once we get to humans, there's nothing, or even below humans, because the computer is able to process much faster, not just qualitative, but quantitative intelligence.
Uh-huh.
It's much more, much bigger. So once we get there, there's nothing stopping intelligence from getting farther. Humans are not the thing that are in the top of the hierarchy of nature. We're not there. There's not a top. It's just problem solving all the way down. And if you develop a technology that's able to solve problems in a better way that our minds have been until now, that thing is hypothesized to be able to retrofeed itself into infinity and just explode in intelligence.
Yeah. Yeah. But still you need human judgment, right? About what we actually want, what we think is important, what something is worth. I don't know. Right?
Now we're questioning what's real.
another point, well, that has to do, like, I was saying that I wouldn't want you to have a very high IQ, for example, because that would mean that my IQ is relatively lower. But at the same time, I think people with an extremely high IQ invent things that are good for the whole species. Well, many people with a very high IQ at the same time, while inventing new things, they suffer a lot because they don't fit in society and they actually have horrible lives. So in that sense, we could also say, if we would decide that, okay, some people are extremely smart and the rest could be like average, like... Yeah, could also be an option.
So you maximize the technological output, but you minimize the suffering because maybe IQ is correlated with suffering?
I don't know if IQ is correlated. I don't think it's like that.
It's probably the opposite.
Yeah, it's probably the opposite because I think that like having a high IQ is exceptional. The society is not really, especially the society from 50 years ago, if you were an exception, you couldn't find your niche in the world. You were just the smart person within your community, and you wouldn't be understood, and you would probably suffer from that, I would say. Nowadays, the suffering would be less because you can find your niche, and you can build your life in a way that suits you. You have more flexibility to adjust your surrounding to yourself. So, the thing is that I think that a high IQ is not correlated or not per se related to suffering. I think it might rather be the opposite because you have more resources to manage your life and you're better at analyzing what needs to be done to improve your life or to improve yourself or whatever. So yes, I think a lot of people that are very, very smart are suffering. Or maybe it's just a typical image. Maybe it's not like that. Maybe it's just my idea. But I have the feeling that a lot of smart people are depressed as well. And but I don't think it's per se related.
Why do you care about being depressed? Is that the thing that you are trying to minimize? Why?
Why? Because for me, a feeling of depression or a feeling of being down is for me is suffering. For me, it's suffering. For me, it's the thing you want to. For me, it's one of the feelings you you want to avoid, because it feels bad. It feels bad.
That's the closest we can get to absolute reality. If that's not real, if suffering is not real, or pain, or a bad feeling, if that's not real, there's nothing we can defend.
Yeah.
The scientific method doesn't make any sense at all if you cannot accept that as a given.
I agree completely with you. And I think that for me, that is like, there are a lot of, you can have a big discussion about what is a good feeling, what is well-being, is that dopamine, is that serotonin, is it not dopamine or serotonin, maybe it's just like a feeling of purpose, a feeling of belonging, is you cannot put it in exact terms, but I'd like to think that we can agree that good feelings are good and bad feelings are bad. We can make it as complex as we want, because you can discuss endlessly about what is the best feeling and what is the worst feeling. Like, is a panic attack the worst feeling? Is a psychosis a bad feeling? Is being depressed a bad feeling? But I know that I prefer to be ecstatic over being depressed, and I think there are some general rules we can agree on, and whether that's true or not, I don't fucking care, because it's, for me, it's true. Like, for it's if we are starting to doubt that, then no single conversation has any purpose, right? That's a bit how I see it. Like, how do you see that?
I'm not sure if that's true. If there's nothing you can build out of from, because if you are questioning the thesis that not even suffering is real, you are at least saying that the thesis that suffering is real is real. At least that thing that you are questioning is real. So there's something that you can build out into. I intuitively feel like you can at least build something out of that super small amount of further truth that you are. You cannot destroy truth completely. You always have something. Whatever you have used to destroy the previous thesis is the new thesis. And however small that thesis is, even if you can put it into a byte of information, you still have something. So I don't know if it's completely true that once you debunk everything, you are left with anything, with nothing. Maybe there's something left. But I'm not sure if building out of that is possible at all, because you maybe that thing would question itself when it's built.
I think about the, which philosopher was it? Descartes, right? Who said, like, I think and therefore
I exist.
Therefore I exist. Yeah, it's interesting. But I'm thinking, for example, about seeing color. So I see the color blue. If you could discuss whether the color blue does exist, because in the end it are just like, how do you say, you can zoom in on it further and it doesn't really exist. It are just wavelength, right? Yep. And I don't know how exactly the science behind it, but I know that it depends a lot on how we perceive the world and how we interpret those waves. But it's true for me, like, blue exists for me. Like,
but think of what it would be required to define blue rigorously. You would need to take the photons emitted by an object at a certain wavelength that get into some receptors in your retina, in the back of your retina, in your eye, which get transmitted in a certain wave, in a certain pathway of neurons towards the brain, and the brain's neurons interact in a certain way. I do not know how those neurons interact. I've got no idea what that feels like. I know how it feels like, but I do not know what the correct definition of that would be like. But in order to establish a rigorous definition of blue, of the perception of blue, that's what it would be like. Because when we define blue and not the perception of it, we are presupposing the existence of the thing behind your eyes. And if we do not presuppose anything at all, you would have to put into the definition the physical definition of what makes your consciousness exist, which is super fucking hard. Because and if you are doing that, you cannot even presuppose the existence of something in the person who is analyzing that description. So you would also have to describe that so that he can build that. So in order to be able to perceive blue, what do I have to do in order to be able to perceive blue? Okay, you have a retina, you have a brain, and it interacts in this certain way when some wavelength get into the retina. Okay, But what are you using to be able to interpret that? I should also give you the pathway to be able to build that. And if I cannot even presuppose that there will be someone analyzing the thing that is supposed to be used to be analyzing the other thing,
mm-hmm.
unless I build everything out of ether,
mm-hmm.
I cannot do anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this thought just blows my mind.
Yeah, okay, let's go back to feel good feelings and bad feelings or feelings that we want and feelings that we don't want, right? Things we want to increase, things we want to decrease or avoid. Why would we look further than our judgment of what are good feelings and what are bad feelings?
Are you talking about temporal preference?
No, but explain yourself.
If we're trying to minimize the amount of suffering in the world,
mm-hmm.
I do not understand why we would try to minimize suffering in the next 5 seconds and not in the whole entirety of the existence of the universe.
Ah, yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Because let's say that by now suffering a lot, the mm-hmm. worst we could maximize the odds of humanity surviving and eventually colonizing the whole
mm-hmm.
Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of living human beings that would be able to exist mm-hmm. would in such a big proportion outnumber the people living now
mm-hmm.
that there's nothing that we cannot sacrifice, that even if it only gave one probability out of millions,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't be worth sacrificing. Let's say we sacrifice 99.99% of our GDP and our well-being right now
yeah.
to increase the odds of that super galactic civilization of existing by one odd in a billion.
Yeah.
It would be worth it, according to this utilitarian standard.
Yeah, exactly, because I was about to say that, from that standard, but then there are other ways to look at it. What is it? I could agree with it if I don't say I don't agree with it. I think there are many different ways to look at it, and I think that if we would live those beautiful times in the future, in which maybe we crack our DNA code and we live happily ever after, and we have only dopamine and serotonin and good feelings in our brain, and depression doesn't exist, and everything is good. If we would live that experience, then it would make more sense maybe to say that we have to go through a difficult time in which maybe we have to suffer, but we have to take into consideration our future, right? I mean, that's what we do with children. We send them to school, they hate it. Well, that's not true, but even if children would hate school, we would send them to school because it's good for them on the longer term. But if children would have to go to school just for the next generation to live well, I think there you could not agree with that, right?
So the more you separate the reward,
yeah.
the least valuable it is?
I'm not sure. I don't say that I see it like that. I'm quite a consequentialist, I think. I'm quite agreeing with utilitarianistic
yes.
thoughts.
Yes.
Wow, okay, one try, it went well. I quite agree with that. But I think that many people don't. So I don't know.
Maybe we should be taking into account that our judgments are not perfect
mm-hmm.
in the equation.
Mm-hmm.
So we shouldn't be given how much certitude or how sure are you that your evaluations are correct?
Mm-hmm.
If you are saying, okay, there's one odd out of a billion of a mm-hmm. million billion people existing in mm-hmm. a billion years.
Mm-hmm.
So let's give everything we have now to increase that odds by that much.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think of your calculation as not being perfect,
mm-hmm.
maybe you should discount the validity of your judgment. But here comes my superior level of skepticism.
All right.
Why is your evaluation going to be presupposed to be incorrect in the direction of being better than it actually will be? What if it actually was worse? And the odds of you getting that supergalactic civilization was actually not one in a billion, but one in 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
If I do not see how we could use the imprecision in our judgments to devalue future outcomes in a way that makes them less valuable, not more. Because your error in your judgments,
mm-hmm.
I guess, mm-hmm. are not systematically biased towards judging things in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, well, maybe yes, but I don't see a reason why.
Mm.
And if we are not systematically biased towards judging things in a positive way,
mm-hmm.
we're not optimistic mm-hmm. and we are just neutral, I don't see a reason why discount our judgments about why in a billion years there will be 1 billion, one out of a billion probability of getting a supergalactic civilization, and let's give everything for that. Maybe it's not a supergalactic civilization. Maybe it's a billion supergalactic civilizations. And what do we do then? Or maybe it's not one, and everything gets collapsed because we discover a way mm-hmm. of producing black holes, putting mm-hmm. sand into a microwave, and then everyone produces one, and the whole civilization collapses.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting to look back. I'm not so history focused, but if you would ask people 100 years ago or 200 years ago, what is the thing the world needs, they would give you very interesting answers if you ask them 100 years ago and 200 years ago and 1,000 years ago and 10,000 years ago. Can we know what we want in the future?
No one knew.
Can we know what is needed in the future? So I think it's, I can imagine, like I have the feeling that that we know a lot more than before, but I think that's an illusion. And I think in 100 years we're gonna laugh about the conversations we have nowadays, right? I don't know. I could think so. So are you gonna? But also we're basing our conversation on the supposing that something good for the coming generations is suffering right now, right? A bit like,
yeah, we're presupposing that future well-being requires current suffering.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm not so, well, maybe, yeah, maybe in some sense, because for example, using fossil fuels in that sense fucks up our, in my opinion, our the future generations, and so it's a kind of egocentric thing to do in a certain way, and not using fossil fuels includes suffering because we cannot do the things we want to do, and we have to find other ways, and it's not always possible to find other ways. Maybe we have a lot more hunger and everything. And maybe a lot more people die. So, yeah, it could be that there's some suffering included.
I think there's trade-offs all the way down.
Mm.
There's nothing else apart from trade-offs. Because there's an amount of suffering generated by stopping to use fossil fuels
mm-hmm.
that would justify using fossil fuels if the impact of fossil fuels is limited.
Mm.
Let's say using fossil fuels is bad, but mm-hmm. up to a certain level.
Mm-hmm.
Only X amount of chaos is going to be generated. I'm not saying it's small or big. I'm just saying an amount.
All right, an X amount, all right.
So if stopping to use them would mm-hmm. generate X amount, more than X amount of suffering,
mm-hmm.
then using them will create, I think using them is perfectly justified. So now the question is, which is the worst evil?
Which is the?
The worst evil.
In what sense? What do you mean?
What option is better? Or less worse?
Yeah. Less worse. Yeah. It's bad. Yeah.
Because no one has ever done any...
Yeah.
A different question than this.
Yeah.
In the history of humanity, if you ask everyone, no one would have given you a response apart from... Okay, so according to what I know, I know that there's some trade-offs here, but I think that this... A is better than this B, this second option. No one ever thought in another way than this.
Mm-hmm.
If you have two options and you have to choose and you judge the trade-offs,
mm-hmm.
you might have concealed desires.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say I want to help some people out to build their house, but I could get some more money by stopping to help them and go to work that day. So maybe I invent that I have cancer and I cannot assist you in the building of your house so mm-hmm. that I can get some more money. So maybe me choosing to do one thing, I'm concealing my hidden desires that I'm not signaling to you. But I cannot conceal desires to myself. I know that I'm saying bullshit. So according to your consciousness, you're not lying to yourself, at least.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot be lying to yourself. Well, yes, fooling yourself is the easiest thing to do, as Richard Feynman said, but I think that there's a level of analysis in which you cannot fool yourself. The thing that's...
Yeah, but then to bring that realization into practice, I'm thinking about effective altruism. Eh? Like when I look at the facts, I can only come to the conclusion that it's very stupid that I do so little for other people. So, and then if someone would ask me, if I ask myself, okay, so you have the choice to do nothing and you have the choice to do more for other people, maybe to donate to certain organizations, or maybe to try to do something myself, if I'm convinced that I can do it better than organizations. And then I'm like, I'm going to do that. I need to do that because I want to be a good person. And then reality comes and then I don't do anything. So, or I don't do nothing, but I do very little. So apart from your judgment about what is good or it's, there's human nature that limits us in doing it. And there are a lot of practical, I mean, if we're thinking about, I was talking about Esperanto, like, you know, the language,
rational,
right?
Language.
Yeah, the rational language, the language that was supposed to be spoken by everyone in the world. It would be very, very nice if all the governments would have said, like, 100 years ago, okay, this is going to be the new world language because it's very efficient to learn, because it's made in a way that it's easy to learn for people from different cultures, etc. But I didn't do it. And now English is a bit like, well, in Chinese and maybe a bit Spanish, but are the world languages. And so you can say, no, but they should have said 100 years ago, they should have made this collective effort of like saying, no, Esperanto is going to be the thing because it would be more efficient. Maybe more people, I mean, you can discuss that, but it might be the case that more people speak Esperanto than that people speak English nowadays. And so more people are able to communicate with each other. Okay, well, they should have made that collective choice, but that you don't take the practical thing into consideration. I mean, if one country would have said, like, imagine Sweden as a very progressive country, like, okay, yeah, we're gonna promote Esperanto. Like, they're fucking stupid if they do it, because you know that the rest of the world is not going to do it. So
they already speak a language which no one else speaks, so it's not that different.
Mm-hmm.
But the root of their...
Ah, like that. You mean that you replace Swedish with Esperanto?
Yeah, but there would be it's not just external friction. There's uh-huh. also a huge internal friction.
Uh-huh.
Why the fuck is this bureaucrat telling me that I have to learn this other language and forget mine? I'm fine with Swedish. Why the fuck do I have to learn Esperanto now? Uh-huh. I don't want to. Fuck you. And
I would feel like that, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would fucking burn Esperanto if someone would oblige me to learn it. Yeah.
But that's the high cost of nationalism.
Mm.
So you're more or less making the case for the huge cost of nationalism. And I think it's true. The more nationalistic people are, mm-hmm. the more segregated they are. And the least economies of scale you can build.
Hmm.
If you check, you can see that between Spanish and English, the amount of content online published mm-hmm. in English is much higher quality and much bigger.
Yeah.
In quantity.
Yeah, yeah.
It's bigger in quantity and in quality. It's amazing than mm-hmm. in Spanish. And it's a tragedy that there's so many billions of people speaking in a language which is not adding to the common pool of the economy of scale that's the biggest. That is the English language. So all those people not speaking in English is not allowing something to be greater than it could have been.
Hmm.
But who is going to be the one starting
the
change?
Who the fuck is going to make everyone speak English? Yeah.
Or not even English. English could be argued to be an irrational and stupid language, which it is.
Which it is. It is fucking stupid. Why do we speak English?
No, I mean, the correlation between phonetics and written language makes no sense.
No sense. It makes no sense. The grammar is, well, it's easier than some other languages, but it's definitely not easy. And
it's not rational.
No. It's an awful language to make everyone learn. It's like, really? Why do we all learn this language? Yeah.
And the other thing I've noticed is that weeks have 7 days. It might have something to do with the
really,
moon.
Really? You have noticed that?
Yeah.
Sorry, continue.
And we're in the year 2022,
uh-huh.
Which means that there has been 2022 years before us since a guy died in a cross, which I'm not arguing for or against now. I'm just saying that there's also 12 months in a mm-hmm. year, and mm-hmm. there's also 30 or 31,
31
or 29 or 28 days in a month, which is...
29 we also have, I thought. All right.
It's arbitrary. But
all right.
never mind. I'm just saying that there's many variabilities, but there hasn't been... If you check how many digits you have to use to express a date,
uh-huh.
it's 2 for the day, 2 for the month, and 4 for the year.
Uh-huh.
That makes 8.
Uh-huh.
But if you check how much information you could express with 8 mm-hmm. digits,
mm-hmm.
if you were counting how many days passed since the first
yeah.
day,
yeah.
it would be considerably shorter
yeah.
than 8 digits.
Mm-hmm.
So all those huge amount of digits and separations between days and months,
mm-hmm.
it's just an inefficient way of communicating the date. Because you could communicate that with 5 digits. There hasn't been a million days since the beginning of 2,000 yeah. years ago.
Yeah.
You could express that with 5 digits, but we use 8 and separations between the digits just because we like it.
Yeah, but it's lovely to think in years. It's like, my New Year's resolutions, like I'm going to go to the gym. I mean, you wouldn't have those things if you would just count the days, you know?
You could. Divide that by 365 and you get... years.
Yeah, it doesn't have the same fanciness, right? If you see the number changing, like the number that's the same all year around, and you see it changing, it's like, whoa, something's changing. Like the same with months. It's like, fuck, another month passed. I really have to start working on my thesis because I only have 3 months left now, you know? If you would count back the days, I think we would procrastinate a lot more if we would count the days.
Not if we got used to it. Because you would say, okay.
Yeah, that's true. Also.
Day 200,
yeah.
255,652.
Mm-hmm.
I have to get this done in the day. I don't remember what number I just said. In that number plus.
That's the problem, Alex. You cannot remember that.
So let's say
it's very difficult.
Let's say you add 60 to that, uh-huh. and then you say, okay, I have to get this finished by X plus 60 so that I get this done. But it's not tangible. So mm-hmm. maybe in the same way, this gets the whole circle closed.
Check this.
In the same way that we are criticizing dates for not... I'm criticizing dates for not...
Don't include me in this. I love dates.
in the same way that I'm criticizing dates for not being rational.
Mm-hmm.
But dates are built in a way that make the passing of time tangible and aligned with our feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're not built to feel as emotional or to feel in such a tangible way the mm-hmm. passing of one number of 5
mm-hmm.
than the digits in a date.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that modification from absolute efficiency, that would be the 5 digits, makes us be more aligned with what our environment requires for us to flourish. And flourish, I define it by minimizing suffering.
Mm.
Maybe there can be an analogous modification that we can do to the effective altruism movement. That might not be the most rational and efficient thing. We might have to sacrifice some digits of efficiency,
uh-huh.
metaphorically,
uh-huh.
but it would minimize the amount of suffering.
Uh-huh. All right, I kind of follow you, I think, but elaborate a bit. So what would be the trade-off in effective altruism, or what are the digits you...
What if we do a party for every 1,000... dollars that are donated to our non-profit organization.
All right, yeah, I understand it.
We do a party that costs 500 euros.
Yeah.
But people feel great doing it.
Yeah, and they are donating more.
Yeah, so you're...
Makes them donate more.
You are burning some digits and you're doing stupid things, but we are stupid.
We are fucking stupid. We have to accept it. But that's the awful thing about effective altruism. That is like, once you start thinking about it, you enter a kind of analysis paralysis of like, you never can make the right decision because it's very difficult as a human. Like, for example, if I have to, I realize that I would like to do more for the world. All right, so what are my options? I can give food to the guy that's always sitting in my street, like asking for money. I can give him food. That would be nice. That would be very nice of me, I think. I think it would help him. I think it makes the world a better place. All right, the other thing is I could use that money to give it to an organization. I don't give it to an organization because that doesn't make me feel good. I'm not motivated enough for it. But I neither give it to that guy because that makes me feel stupid. I'm stupid if I give that to that guy because I could have given that money to an organization. That makes me do nothing at all. So it's awful to realize that this is awful. It's awful. Effective altruism, no, it's not awful, but it's like, I think it paralyzes us a lot.
Effective altruism is like the 5 digits of the date.
Yeah, could be.
And we need an 8-digit version. What is the 8-digit version of effective altruism, which is less efficient, but maximizes the amount of well-being in people? Maybe our current date is not the most efficient, but it's a more efficient than the shitty 5-digit version that I could invent. And also, there's something that we are not analyzing, because you are trying to make a decision between two options. You are judging whether to give to the charity or to the guy in front of you. But you are not judging the thing behind that judgment.
Mm-hmm.
There's two options that you can take.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are put into a situation in which you have to decide between two options.
Mm-hmm.
But you are not questioning whether making that decision is correct by some other previous judgment.
Yeah.
You are just given the judging of the two options.
Yeah.
And maybe if you judge the judging of that thing, you would realize that, okay, this doesn't make sense. I'm limited to only two options. Mm-hmm. I should be having some other options. Mm-hmm. I know that all the prosperity in the world has come out of human ingenuity. And what's a way of maximizing human ingenuity in the future in a way that maximizes that I can trust? In a way that I can trust. Okay, I know that I exist. Or at least that's the thing that I am the most sure about.
Yeah.
I do not know how the accounting of the company I could donate to works.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know if this boy in front of me will spend all the money in alcohol. I do not know what anything will turn out to be. But I do know that I can start a YouTube channel doing videos, talking to people about effective altruism and trying to spread the word of helping other people. Mm-hmm. Or I could start a business or a company sharing knowledge about science or anything that would make an impact and that I can be sure that impact would be achieved. Because if you have to take into account how uncertain are you that company will actually be investing that money.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a 1% odds, 1% uncertainty of that happening, you have to take that into account into judging whether your investment is correct or not.
Definitely. And with the movement of effective altruism, what is very relevant is that not many people know about it. So there's like a big, I think, for example, like I'm a vegetarian. And this example comes up because I think that I did more good to the world saying that I'm a vegetarian to other people than actually being a vegetarian.
Yes, you do.
Because I know a lot of people who became a vegetarian and they're definitely, at least for maybe a percentage, influenced by me, for sure, for sure. And I'm definitely influenced by other people who told me they were a vegetarian. So in the end, maybe we should just act as if we're doing good, and maybe we should just spread the word and then and do nothing at all. So no, but that wouldn't be a good option as well, but neither. But no, but I think we should, if we're talking about effective altruism, we should take into consideration that spreading the word is a big part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And showing that you're doing good is a big part of doing good. Because it's contagious. Like, if you're doing good, someone else sees that you're doing good. It works like that. Our psychology works like that. So, but that's the kind of paradox, because often people who show off that they're doing good, we hate them. We hate people who show that they're doing good. Like, I hate people who show that they're doing good, who because it often includes a kind of, I'm feeling better, I'm better because I'm doing good. But I think it's very good to think that you're actually better when you're doing good, because it makes us do more good.
Mm. So in the same way that you feel like the person who's doing good and signaling it is a bad person because he's explicitly trying to get acceptance from people.
Yeah.
So it's not altruistic.
Yeah.
But getting rid of the illusion of altruism, because it doesn't exist, allows you to recognize how rational we are.
Yeah.
And trying to maximize the amount of good acting in the world would pass through giving that person the credit of, hey, well done. Mm-hmm. You've given the money. You should keep doing this. You're a really good person.
Yeah.
Maybe just saying that would improve the world in the best possible way, and accepting the ego of that person. Okay, you have an ego and you want to feed it by giving money and then signaling that on Instagram. But what if accepting and giving him some of the credit is the best way of maximizing the altruism that ends up happening?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's definitely the case. We are not rational beings. Yeah. And we have an ego. And
I think this idea goes to the third layer of the analysis.
Mm-hmm.
It's not only what you feel, but what you feel it should be feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just what you like or what you would like to like.
Uh-huh.
But knowing your biological limitations.
Yeah.
Let's see what is reasonable to expect me to like. To like.
Yeah.
So it's like when you build a second layer of complexity, when you say, what would I like to like?
Uh-huh.
You are getting away from your meat and bones limitations, which your prefrontal cortex allows you to do somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
But then recognizing that you are still limited by your meat and bones, which is what composes your prefrontal cortex. Well, only meat, not bones, but allows you to understand your physical limitations one layer deeper, and not only try to impose rationality into the world saying, fuck your English, learn Esperanto, it's much more efficient, let's all use economies of scale and get the most prospects possible. Maybe that message is objectively the best, and that's the thing that should be done in order to maximize well-being in the world. That's the five-digit option of the date. But what if the eight-digit one is the only one that could be implemented because people have meat and bone limitation of meat, which is due to his biology?
Very interesting, because I think that often we think our image of rationality is very different than what rationality actually is. I think we often think that one thing is the most rational thing to do, but we're naive in the sense that we don't include our own subjectivity in.
Oh, that's so good.
I think so, right? Because I think it's like that. Often, for example, the ambition to make the whole world speak Esperanto, we could say, well, it's always easy in retro perspective to say, to judge, but we can say it's naive. It's like it was one step further than the first wanting level, because it's like, okay, I want to learn English because this is the thing that's going to give me access. All right, if we look at it on a collective level, it would be better to learn Esperanto. So we should also, on an individual level, want to learn Esperanto. So we should want to learn Esperanto as a collective. But then the realization that the psychology of the collective doesn't work like that, it's simply not in our nature. Or it also has to do with politics, because we are not in a...
But it's the same.
In a communistic country where people can tell us that we have to learn Esperanto, and we neither want to be in such a society.
No, but politics here are irrelevant. The root is the same. The root is the nationalistic feeling of the individual. If no one had that, there wouldn't be politics that are restraining your decision making.
Yeah. All right. So let's keep it at the psychology of the group, right?
Psychology
on an individual level, and maybe on a group level. I don't know if you would say it like that, but I see it a bit like that. And then it's super naive to not take into consideration what are the limits of that, I think, right? Yeah.
Let me put it into an elegant phrase that I think should be put into stone.
Very good.
If I do not take into account your irrationality.
Mm-hmm.
I am irrational.
Exactly. Beautiful, beautiful. Let's put it on the wall. Let's write it on a tile. No, but yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
It's not only about taking into account what is the thing that you can machinate or build that would maximize well-being. Uh-huh. You're not trying to maximize paperclips.
Uh-huh.
Or if you were, you would realize that, hey, there's other factors that matter. And then suddenly you would realize that maximizing paperclips is not sustainable. Yeah. Or
yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it makes me think of I'm from the Netherlands, and there climate change is like a big, big, big issue in the leftish circles. And everyone is like focusing on the individual responsibility. And I think that definitely makes some of a contribution. And I'm also a victim of that of that philosophy, that's gonna change the world. But in the end, like, they don't like if you scream like, or if you say like, if your statement is like, but everyone should think in this way, or everyone should be rational, is like, or everyone should care about climate change, we should make a collective effort, is like, yeah, okay, but that's not how things work. That's not the way you can influence, you know?
Like, you're being irrational at a different level.
Yeah, at a different level. So you make one step. You make one step from you're definitely more, you could say that you're more rational than someone who says that that we should all burn all the fossil fuels we find without making any good use of it, for example. You make one step more because you reason in a better way, but you still don't have the full picture in consideration. But it's difficult because then where you can always say that another person doesn't have everything into consideration. Mm. So even the third layer, maybe there's a fourth layer, and you realize like, whoa, you are naive. You think this, but that's bullshit because you forgot this factor, for example. I'm not so sure where it adds. When we can know that we know things.
Exactly. But I think that the way science solves this is with empirical evidence.
Mm.
You test it at a minimum, at a small scale, and then there are some things that cannot be applied at small scale, mm-hmm. but some other things are.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can test your thesis in a smaller scale so mm-hmm. that it requires a smaller investment.
Mm-hmm.
And if it seems to work, you make it bigger, and then based on the previous empirical evidence,
mm-hmm.
you justify the investment in a bigger thing. You don't start top down investing $1,000 billion
mm-hmm.
dollars into a project because a person thought of it being a good decision.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be bottom up. It has to be people trying through trial and error, new decisions, and seeing what works. And if there's a process of natural selection that can be applied there,
mm-hmm.
permit the good ideas to be filtered into the top of the hierarchy mm-hmm. and let those rule what things should be done.
Yeah.
But there's things that cannot be generated at the lowest possible level of selection.
Mm-hmm.
There's some ideas that have to be created from the top
mm-hmm.
that couldn't be imposed, couldn't be created bottom up.
Yeah.
There's some mandates that have to be, by definition, top down, mm-hmm. like in Tragedy of the Commons. If everyone can do something that benefits themselves but is bad for the collective, it will be horrible. No one will do anything good. So there's a requirement of a top-down entity that coerces everyone against their will to do what they do not want to mm-hmm. in order for everyone to be better off.
Mm-hmm.
And I, being a super libertarian, would be a skeptical mm-hmm. of most of the things that are said to be the case.
Yeah.
But I also accept, and I think it's right to do so, that there's some things that have to be collectively decided because not everything can be bottom up.
Yeah, but when we're talking about research, like, what I highly question is whether we can find truth by looking at empirical data, because it has so much to do with our own philosophy, and in the first place we decide to look at certain things and not to look at other things, and maybe we have blind spots. And the difficult thing is when you don't know that you have blind spots. And I'm thinking about the book you recommended me, Fossil Fuels, which I didn't read, but I think the main thesis,
Fossil Future,
Fossil Future. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's clearly that obviously that I didn't read it because I don't even know the title.
Yeah.
But Fossil Future, and their main thesis is that it's not bad in itself to burn fossil fuels, right?
Exactly.
Which goes radically against against, I think, well, at least my personal philosophy or my personal ideas, my personal understanding of the world. And I think that if within my framework I do research, I kind of reaffirm my own thoughts about the world because I look at empirical data in a certain way. But then there's philosophy, and you can think about the world in a radical different way, or you can reconsider things, and then suddenly you see things in another light. So by just looking at empirical data, we cannot conclude whether burning fossil fuel is better good, I would say. Or do you think so?
Looking at empirical data, I think that you can conclude that burning fossil fuels is the only rational thing to do.
Hmm.
Well, but that's my opinion. That's just my opinion. That's just, we're trying to do a meta-analysis of how to have a good opinion, not determine what the good opinion is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, trying to determine what the good way to find a good opinion is also an opinion in itself.
Yeah. We're stuck.
We're stuck with opinions. There's nothing apart from opinions. So maybe going down to a lower level, I could argue for the consumption of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that carbon dioxide is plant food and...
Definitely, but...
Definitely good.
It's definitely plant food, definitely. But we have a lot of it and we don't have so many plants, right? But let's not go into this maybe, right? Because
it's a bit too
complex. we can make another podcast about this, and I'd love to first read the book Fossil Future. Fossil Future, right?
Yeah. By Alex Epstein.
All right. And then we can discuss that. That would be very nice. That would be very nice. But I'd really like to read that book because I think it's a very... It's so radically different from what I believe that I think it could be.
Mm. This makes me think of how you are approaching this situation. Instead of directly rejecting the opposite opinion, you are trying to see if you left something out of your analysis.
Mm-hmm.
That's the correct way of going through it. I'm not saying that, oh, this girl is supposed to abuse I hold so that she could see my view. This transcends our personal situation. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is that as the ethos of escaping mediocrity, that the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us.
I like that.
If we permit selection to occur at a lower level, the higher level doesn't get fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And we are doing that by allowing our thoughts to be selected for at the level of thoughts so that we do not suffer the consequences personally.
Yeah.
So you have to separate yourself from your ideas.
Yeah.
And I think that the approach you are having towards this is close to what I consider to be the optimal one.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be open and seeing if there's other options that you haven't taken into consideration in your analysis.
Yeah. It makes me think about a completely different topic. The how do you say, the anthem? No, the main idea of your podcast, right? Like, let ideas die instead of people. That's the idea, right? It makes me think of freedom also, and why freedom is so important, and why experiment is so important, and why it's so important to try out things, because you can have very good ideas, but often it's not so clear whether things are gonna work. So you have to... I'm thinking specifically about the education system now, because that's one subject that I thought about, but I think you can apply it to a lot of things. But for example, in the education system, if you want to decide top down how education exactly looks like based on, for example, the experience we have so far and based on what science says, I think you're missing out on a great opportunity to actually evolve education, because you're kind of making every school work in the same way. And if you don't experiment, you're never going to discover better ways. Maybe we already have good ways, but maybe there are excellent ways. Maybe there are awesome ways. And that makes me think of that, because I think that freedom in that sense is very important, because this the same as freedom of expression, right? the freedom to express whatever you think. Let ideas die instead of people. Let schools die instead of the whole school system of a country, right?
Exactly,
like, I mean, exactly. We need to be able to experiment. I mean, if there's a school who wants to experiment with kids not learning how to read until they're eight, well, that's quite I think that's quite radical. But if there is any proof that it might work, then I would say give it a go, right?
I mean, what if I would argue that, okay, let's not let them try that radical stance,
mm-hmm.
because with a less radical decision, we could see the benefit of that measure. Instead of going to from the black to the white,
we could
do a gray,
yeah.
and see if there's half the benefit.
Yeah.
And if you prove half the benefit, we can go all the way.
Yeah.
So instead of risking the whole thing, the whole school, risk half of it.
Yeah, I understand. But there's an interesting thing, I think, and especially in high schools, you see that, but also in primary schools, but especially in high schools. They have centralized exams, right? So you have, all the schools have the same exams, at least in the Netherlands, like that all the schools in the country do the exact same exams. Based on that, the school is being judged. But maybe we should judge people in other ways. Maybe we should judge people on their presentation skills or their social skills or their entrepreneurial skills. If you would start a school right now, and you would give that school 5 years to prove itself, and instead of learning an extra language, you are going to learn to be an entrepreneur, and you would test in 5 years whether that works and whether the level of entrepreneurial skills those kids own is acceptable compared to learning an extra language. You're probably gonna find that they don't really know how to do entrepreneurship, because you need to evolve. You need that culture to come into existence, and you need such a radical different way of education. Because how are you gonna learn kids how to do entrepreneurship? You're not gonna teach that in a classic way. So you have to make those kids do things and outside of the classroom, and you have to have different teachers, and you have to find a good way to do that. So if you only give 5 years time, if you try to make small changes but keep the same end criteria for a school, which are the centralized exams, even if you would be flexible in those centralized exams and you would say you get a certain amount of years to do it differently, then probably you would find that they don't do it well enough, and you go back to the old system. So I think that I once made an analogy between evolution of genes and evolution of the school system, and where reproduction is like the end goal of genes, right? Always like indirect or direct. The end goal of a school will always be its end criteria, because its right to exist is depending on that. If they don't score well enough, the school is dying, right?
It's hard to convince a man of something if he's getting paid requires him not understanding it.
yeah, exactly. So if we in evolution, we cannot really say like, okay, no, the more important things for genes is to not to reproduce but to be happy or to be empathic or whatever. We don't have that freedom, but in this education system, we have the freedom to change the end criteria. We can say we can change them, and that costs a lot of years to create a different system. And we should not only give 1 year for a school to try that out. We should give years and years and years. We should give a lot of freedom, because we don't have the overview of what could happen there, you know. And we need to experiment. I would say, my personal opinion, very personal opinion.
In relation to the entrepreneurship thing, I think that how can you be sure that entrepreneurship can be taught top down? What mm-hmm. if it's not top down and it's a bottom up process?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of the Goodhart's law?
No.
And this reminds me of in the Netherlands, they have a top-down test, and they try to test everyone with that. And according mm-hmm. to that, they get more approval or less. And that gets you a number
mm-hmm.
which schools are trying to maximize.
Mm-hmm.
And the Goodhart's law states that when a measure becomes a target, mm-hmm. it ceases to be a good measure. In other words,
yeah.
As soon as you start using a measure to try and affect outcomes, these measures become less useful.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you trying to maximize?
Yeah.
What do you want in me? Do you want me to do more push-ups? I will do them.
Mm-hmm.
So I get the money. Mm-hmm. Do you want me to do more pull-ups? I will do them.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not, once you start analyzing something, I will do that. Yeah. I will try to optimize for that.
Yeah.
And in the same way that you were criticizing schools for trying to maximize the thing that you were evaluating them for, you are still doing that. And I'm not claiming that I'm apart from a process of natural selection in my ideas. The same thing applies to me.
Mm-hmm.
I do not know how to get away of this process of retrospective analysis, which I cannot get away from. But never mind. What I'm saying is that there's something in you.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of schools not having to be subject to a process of natural selection in terms of existing, because existing is not the metric that we're trying to maximize, but the well-being of kids.
Yeah.
In the same way that you're criticizing that, your idea of that criticism is still being subject to the process of natural selection in your internal reward system in your brain.
Mm-hmm.
You are considering that idea attractive and not the alternative. So that idea is the one which was the best at reproducing itself so that you processed it the most.
Yeah.
There's not way of getting away from natural selection.
Yeah. There's no way to escape from that. Yeah. No, I agree completely with you. Interesting, because indeed, once you have a number as an objective, not to measure anything to indicate it, but just as a goal in itself, indeed, it's very difficult. It brings a lot of trouble because many things are not measurable. So we measure the things that are easy measurable, and we cannot measure the things we are not used to measure things as well-being, for example, of kids. I think it's not something that's being measured in schools. I'm not sure. Maybe it is. It should be, at least. I've been into two high schools. The first year I was in high school that was kind of awful, where the culture was very much on the culture was very much like a bit awful, because your personal worth was dependent on the grades you had. That was basically the idea of the school. It worked because kids were scared. Like their worth was dependent on what they did on tests, you know, and parents who wanted their children to do especially good sent their children to those schools. It worked. They scored amazingly good on the end exams. They scored amazingly good. It seemed to be a very good school. It was an awful school. It was an awful school. Nobody there was happy. The teachers weren't happy. The kids weren't happy. Like, what did I learn? I learned to obey, you know?
But you're judging that from a perspective of happiness in the kids. In the terms of maximizing learning, they succeeded.
But it's funny because you learn more as an individual, in the sense like I bet that my French would have been much better if I would have stayed at school, because after 1 year I left. My French would have been better, my English would have been better, my skills that they test at the end they would have been better. But that's individual skills. But as a society, you don't need a group of individuals who have individual skills. You need a kind of variety of people that works together well, that know how to cooperate, that maybe you want one person who's very good at that, one person who's very good at that, one person who specializes in that. So in the end, it's not so important that all the individuals in your school have a good score. It's important that within your society, you have different kind of individuals with different skills, right? Who know how to cooperate, who have social skills, because with only knowing mathematics, you're not coming far in life. You need a lot more than that. So, well, yeah, it's of course my personal experience, and it's a lot based on students' well-being. But I think that we often don't have to take into consideration that the thing that society needs is actually not individual skills, but is a collective skill.
Yeah, there might be some variables that haven't been taken care of when judging exclusively the metric of the marks in a school.
Yeah.
But this made me think of a way in which it succeeded. Your school was successful in maximizing the learning of the kids, not maybe in a way of cohesion societal level.
Yeah, but they definitely learned more.
I'm thinking of...
In those terms, yeah.
I'm going back to the artificial intelligence thing.
Mm-hmm.
When you establish a metric,
mm-hmm.
When you establish a measure to something that's less intelligent than you,
mm-hmm.
like kids are in relationship to parents or,
yeah,
or
yeah.
teachers, it's easy to establish a measure that will not be gamed with. You cannot win this game. You cannot, if I'm more intelligent than you,
mm-hmm.
I will be able to design a metric
mm-hmm.
that you will not be able to game. You will not be able to find a loophole in the system
mm-hmm.
that will make you not have, that will make you fulfill Goodhart's law. Goodhart's law
mm-hmm.
works when people establish rules
mm-hmm.
that apply to people who are at the same level of cognitive capacity or up.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to put a rule to your parents when mm-hmm. you were 8 mm-hmm. and you told them, do this, mm-hmm. and I will measure your validity by this metric,
mm-hmm.
you have to maximize the amount of, I don't know, donuts that are introduced into my bedroom at 7 p.m. Yeah.
Cool
if,
idea.
If you design that and you were 100% happy with that decision,
mm-hmm.
you would find that they would put a certain machine that puts an object that gets detected by your measuring system
mm-hmm.
that seems to be counting as introducing donuts into the mm-hmm. bedroom, so that it's the machine says 1,000,000,000 donuts put into the, technically mm-hmm. that definition is fulfilled, and you wouldn't be fulfilled with that outcome. Why? Mm-hmm. Because your parents are more intelligent than you,
mm-hmm.
and the intelligence is what allows Goodhart's law to be a true one.
Mm-hmm.
Because, but if they were less intelligent,
mm-hmm.
they would be like, oh, well, okay, the only way to do what she wants is to put donuts there. Let's do that.
Mm-hmm.
But intelligence is what allows you to say, okay, what is the definition of donut? What mm-hmm. is the definition of 7 p.m.? What is room?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can I play with any of those variables so that I can get more for less?
Mm-hmm.
That is intelligence, in my opinion. And when you are establishing a measure to a superior entity or to someone of your same level, there's room for wiggle and them gaming the system and being able to maximize output with minimal input. And so Goodhart's law exists, or it's true.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah, I got to think about this. It's nice. All right. So, but one thing I realize is that you have this Goodhart's law, right? And that says that when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. But I, in this moment, I'm trying to have a morning routine. So I have like an Excel sheet with checkboxes to do Spanish every day, to do French every day, to clean my room every day, to what else do I have in that? To have proper breakfast. And it's true that because I have those checkboxes, I do it, because sometimes I don't feel motivated to clean my room and I do it anyways. The cleaning of my room is less effective because I'm doing it without really a lot of excitement. It takes me a bit longer. The learning of the Spanish is a bit more inefficient because I'm not really there with my focus. I'm just doing it to be able to check the box. But at the same time, without those boxes, I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't learn Spanish if I didn't have a checkbox in my Excel sheet. So it's true that a measure, when a measure becomes a target, that it ceases to be a perfect measure, but it's not true that it ceases to be a valuable measure per se, right? I mean, it depends a bit on what.
Do you remember how I said that when you are interacting with an entity that's more intelligent than you,
mm-hmm.
the amount of gaming the system that occurs increases?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you were, because you were the one establishing the measure, and you are the one trying to game it, you're not able to game it completely.
Yeah.
But you are able to game it somewhat.
Yeah.
And be somewhat satisfied by the outcome of that measure.
Yeah.
So if it was a stupid person who did it instead of you,
mm-hmm.
you would be able to, oh, fuck it, I will do this absurd thing which maximizes the points in the game.
Yeah. So there is, because I know that I made those measures in a kind of good way, because I wouldn't have made those measures if I knew that the Spanish I would learn would be, instead of a 10, would be a 1. So I take into consideration when putting the measure that it's probably going to be a 7, but that's a lot better than a 1 or than a 0. So it's worth it. So it's you make a kind of judgment when you make the measurements for yourself.
So you discounted the law.
Yeah.
You discounted Guthart's law in your analysis. Definitely,
because, well, maybe not in the beginning, but I change my morning routine. I don't change it every week, but I look at it every week, and then I decide whether I keep it like that for the next week. So sometimes I change things around a bit. Like, for example, 2 months ago, I wasn't doing any French, and then I decided I want to do some French in my morning routine, and I want to do a bit less of Spanish, and I think it's good to take into my morning routine that I make my bed. So it change, it evolves a bit depending on how it's going. So it's a kind of trial and error in that sense. And so
I love it. I love it.
Yes, yeah, quite nice. It's quite nice. It works quite well. So in the first, when I made the first version, I was very, like, I was kind of looking at my planning and thinking that everything would have a 10 as a 10 out of 10 quality. And then after 1 week, you notice that that's not the case in practice. But it's still a 7, and that makes me decide to keep it. If things are going to be lower, if things are going to be a 5, then I think I'll take it out because it's not worth it. Because in that time, it would be worth more to do something else, right? So, yeah, it's funny. It's funny. And it's interesting with the thing of, like, your previous self isn't more intelligent than your current self, but my previous self can make an estimation or a kind of judgment about how my current self is going to react. So my current self is not tired, so it's very easy for me to make a rule about getting up at 7:50 in the morning. Mm. And I make that, I say 7:50 because I know if I would say 7, my future self wouldn't be able to do it. So I'm kind of playing with where's the limit to what extent can I influence myself? And it really goes like that with my wake up time. Like, really, like, I'm thinking about bringing it down now to get up a bit earlier because I know that I'm able to do this, and I want to know how far I can go in my routine. You know,
that's exactly how it should be. That's it. By exposing yourself voluntarily to chaos or to a level of uncomfortableness that you know is good, mm-hmm. you improve. That's the mm-hmm. way of improving.
Mm-hmm. And and it has to be have a kind of good balance, right? I mean, you have
And you also have to balance the balance. You don't want too much balance.
You want to balance the balance. That's a good one. That's interesting.
This reminds me of an analogy of a tree. I don't mm-hmm. know if we've talked in this podcast about the analogy. But
we haven't.
If there's wind mm-hmm. and you allow the leaves to move, mm-hmm. the movement doesn't get transmitted in such a strong and coordinated way to the roots of mm-hmm. the tree.
Yeah.
But if you not allow the leaves to move, mm-hmm. that's transmitted through the branches to the roots.
Yeah.
Which breaks them if there's enough wind.
Yeah. Yeah, you mean if the tree would be static?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you need to move. You need to permit fluidity in the system. You need to permit some kind of natural selection at a lower level, so that the higher levels don't disappear.
Yeah.
Or break.
Yeah. Funny. That
the same thing happens in society. Uh-huh. We permit entrepreneurs to fail and to suffer a lot, so that the economy in a general way prospers. Uh-huh. You fail, I fail, but maybe some other one will not fail and achieve greatness and allow people to discover a new technology that will revolutionize everything.
Yeah. Yeah, funny. Good analogy. I like the tree analogy.
The same thing as let's permit ideas die instead of us.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good motto. Let's let ideas die instead of us. Exactly.